Hello and welcome to the Kojit podcast series. My name is Anthony Richards and I'm the editorial director of Kojit. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Kurt Braddock. Kurt is an assistant professor at the School of Communication at the American University, Washington, D.C., and is the author of Weaponized Words, The Strategic Role of Persuasion in Violent Radicalization and Counter-Radicalization, which was published in 2020 with Cambridge University Press. Kurt, a very warm welcome to you, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Anthony, thank you for having me. I'm just as delighted to be here.
It's a pleasure. Great to have you with us. I suppose, firstly, in the chapter that you kindly contributed to our volume on jihadist terror, you focus on what you call jihadi narratives and how you counter them. Can I ask, firstly, how important, if at all, do you think it is when countering such narratives? Is that distinction between violent extremism and non-violent extremism? I kind of ask this because, as you know, there is a debate within the academic literature on the extent that non-violent but extremist organizations actually serve as conveyor belts towards, or conversely, firewalls against the use of violence. For example, one category of counter-narratives that you identify is advocating non-violent forms of political dissent, with a subsequent suggestion that any inclination towards violence should be channeled towards the use of perhaps non-violent methods as a means of voicing that dissent, with not necessarily any kind of dissolution of the extremist ideology itself. Do you think this opens a door to a greater role for extremist but non-violent organizations and non-violent extremism in general? And does it imply that these may actually serve as useful firewalls against violence as a result? So I'd be really interested to hear your views on this in terms of the focus when we're countering these narratives. Is it important to draw that distinction between extremism that leads to violence or extremism in general, even if it's non-violent?
Yeah, I think that is the imperative distinction to make in not just counter-narratives, but any kind of strategic counter-communication. One of the things that governments are accused of, academics are accused of, and I mean, just generally, if you want to talk about kind of the counter-terrorist elites are accused of, is trying to police thought and trying to get people and trying to prevent people from having ideas that are just kind of distasteful to us rather than nonviolent. And I think that by trying to prevent kinds of thought that don't advocate violence, or trying to push you back against ideas that we just find distasteful but don't advocate violence, in a lot of the counter-narrative work I've done, one of the warnings I give is not to reinforce the narratives that the groups are already telling. And I think that's the threat that we face when we do that sort of thing. One of the issues this draws out and shows that I'm very much still a student of John Horgan's is that when in my grad school days, we often had debates about what an ideology is. And when we kind of settled on it, we realized, or we talked about how part of an ideology isn't just the ideas that underpin what people believe or the attitudes they develop, but it's also how that leads to different kinds of activities. So I think it's very important to distinguish violent thought or maybe distasteful thought and violent or distasteful action, because it's the action we're trying to stop. We're trying to stop people from being hurt. We're trying to stop people from being killed. And ultimately, we don't want to be in the business of policing thought that doesn't advocate those things.
That's really interesting. Thank you very much, Kurt. And I suppose this also links into sort of the disengagement, de-radicalization discussion as well, doesn't it? The idea that actually it might be easier to persuade someone to disengage from their methods that they're using rather than actually de-radicalize from their worldview or their thought system, I guess. Would you go along with that?
I would absolutely go along with that. And I would go a step further in saying that disengagement should be the first goal. And I mean, if part of the ideology does advocate violence, you do want to try to get somebody to disavow that as well. Ideally, we can get people to stop even believing that violence is warranted, but the first step in all these things needs to be preventing people from engaging violence in the first place. This goes to other debates that I have with Paul Gill, where he comes from a criminological perspective, and we've had talks about ideology, and he tells me, I don't care about ideology. I care about the situational factors that lend themselves to somebody engaging in violence, and how to understand how to limit the degree to which those contextual factors allow somebody to engage in violence, whereas I'm interested in the psychology of it. But this all gets to the idea that we need to understand the distinction between engagement and disengagement, and radicalization and de-radicalization, and trying to prevent engagement and radicalization, though they might be related, the methods we use aren't always going to be exactly the same.
Excellent. No, thank you very much for that. To what extent then do you think that counter narratives actually reinforce the original narrative that it is intended to tackle, and in this sense itself can be counterproductive? Do you think this is particularly the case, for example, with conspiracy theories that we hear a lot about these days?
Yeah, I think that conspiratorial extremism, as I've called it in some of my writing, that it's very, very tricky to try to use counter narratives as they've traditionally been constructed and conceptualized, because the conspiracy narratives have it built into them. It's baked into conspiracies that there is this shadowy group that's trying to control your thought, and any kind of counter message intended to undermine that sort of message gets folded back into the conspiracy narrative, which kind of builds it up. So it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy for a conspiracy narrative. For those, I think the better strategy, rather than try to counter the conspiracy, which, as you said, just feeds into the conspiracy itself, is try to develop counter narratives that highlight how conspiracy is used to persuade individuals who are vulnerable to them. So rather than try to dissuade somebody about ideas that in some cases just aren't falsifiable and there's no way to try to logic themselves out of, try to develop a counter narrative that shows people how they're being exploited by these conspiracies and how they're being used by these groups that exploit these conspiracies and get people to do what they don't normally do. Those are counter narratives too. They're just differently focused than the way we usually think about them.
Thank you, Kurt. I wonder, can you assess the progress that has been made in relation to the measurement of the effectiveness of counter narratives? And indeed, how would you go about measuring the effectiveness of counter narratives in the first place?
I think I'm not speaking out of turn to saying lacking, but I think it's not unique to counter narratives themselves. We generally tend not to be too good at gauging the effectiveness of our counter messaging strategies at large. Counter narratives aren't unique in that respect, but I think we're getting better, and we're getting better because the field as a whole is starting to embrace things like experimental designs, embrace things like surveys to gauge the sorts of perceptions people have about narratives, and embracing large-scale data collection about these things. In the past, they were often just kind of things were thrown at a wall and we hope it sticks, but I think that the field is gaining a better understanding empirically about how data need to be gathered with respect to their effects. Now, you mentioned, how do we measure these effects? There's a couple of ways we can go about it, depending on what your specific strategy is meant to be. I mean, some of the organizations that I've worked with, government and non-government, the way we gauge the effectiveness of the narrative strategies is to engage people in conversation, just gain their perceptions before and after the entire the counter-narrative campaign, for lack of a better term. Sometimes it's more quantitative. Sometimes it's distribution of surveys on a small scale. Something that I'd like to see, and I'm not aware that that's being used in any context yet, of course, I might be wrong, is when larger scale counter-narrative campaigns are laid out in certain contexts, to gather information pre and post-test, or to have a naturally occurring control group to see whether or not these counter-narratives actually have an effect on a larger type scale. Do general populations respond to them in the ways that we're hoping they respond to them? Of course, that's a bit more difficult. I mean, it takes things like research funding and access to government officials with that kind of ability. But I think we're moving in that direction. So I mentioned at the outset, it's lacking, but I am heartened by how much better we're getting at measuring not just counter-narrative effectiveness, but the effectiveness of all of our counter-messaging.
How important then do you think is the messenger in terms of who presents the counter narrative, who conveys the counter narrative, and how important is that in terms of its effectiveness?
arguably just as, if not more important than the message itself, I think. We have more than enough data to show that when the messenger is somebody who's not trusted by the target, that the message not only falls on deaf ears, but can also have a counterproductive effect. I feel bad because it's almost like the whipping boy that I use, but think again, turn away here in the US. It was in 2013 now. It's quite dated now, but it's such a good example of what not to do. But for those who are unfamiliar, the Think Again, Turn Away program, which was rolled out by the Department of State, I think it was the CSCC at the time. They're now the Global Engagement Center with the Department of State, and they're doing a much better job now. They learned from their mistakes. But in 2013, they rolled out a counter-narrative campaign on Twitter where the purpose was to engage directly with ISIS narratives and try to counter them in that public sphere. The problem was that the Twitter account that they were using to do it was overtly affiliated with the Department of State, complete with the seal on the Twitter logo. So imagine what happens when those who are maybe sympathetic towards ISIS are getting counter messages from an official Department of State source. And it turned into just an abject disaster. And it was counterproductive to the point that when it was evaluated by outside evaluators, one of them even said that we need to even evaluate whether we should be in this space at all. So it almost got us out of the counter messaging space altogether. So it does come down to source in a lot of cases. And in a lot of the work that I do, where I work with the smaller organizations, that's what I'm telling the organizations, that you need to find individuals who are already working in these communities, who are trusted by the individuals in these communities, and have them deliver the message. It's not about tricking the messenger. It's not about tricking the message targets. It's about a it's mutual benefit to both governments, organizations, and the individuals who are vulnerable to radicalization to help them avoid what comes along with being exposed to these narratives. So it needs to be a genuine partnership with these smaller organizations, these grassroots organizations. I think they are the most effective messengers that we can engage with.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for sharing that case of what not to do in relation to counter-narratives. Finally, Kurt, I know that your research agenda at the moment is focusing more on right-wing violence and perhaps counter-narratives online against right-wing violence. I wonder if you could share a few thoughts you have on that and where your research is going in relation to that.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for asking, because I'm actually very excited about where it's going. When I started doing the counter-narrative work almost 10 years ago now, 11 years ago now, I wasn't really ideology focused. I was just wanting to look at, understand how narratives work and counter-narratives work in all kinds of contexts. But throughout the Obama administration, we could see in the US that the far right was becoming a problem. We were trying to sound that alarm for a long time. And of course, with the ascension of Trump in 2016, and we saw what that led to on January 6th, it's become very clear that we have a problem here and elsewhere, that the far right needs the attention that we've been calling for a long time. So that's why I'm focused on that particular area. I am interested now, my research agenda, and I'm working on a book proposal and a couple of chapters now I'm sending back out to probably Cambridge again. I've been talking to them, although I don't want to put them on the spot for saying they're taking my book proposal. But what I'm interested in now, and this does focus a bit on the narrative work, is the persuasive power of subtexts among those who have public platforms. So there's a couple of years ago, after the El Paso shootings, other violent events that were at least anecdotally linked to messages that President Trump delivered publicly, I became very interested in understanding this concept of what's called stochastic terrorism. And for those that are unfamiliar, stochasticism, it's a statistical phenomenon where something will reliably occur, but you can never predict when and where it will occur. So the idea, or a good example, is if you're sitting on your front porch or in your back garden and you see clouds rolling in, you know lightning's going to strike somewhere, but you can never really predict when and where it's going to strike. So the idea behind stochastic terrorism is that somebody with a very large public platform, a politician, a pundit, a media personality, they have these platforms where they reach millions and millions of people. And when they say things that can be interpreted as calls to violence, despite not being overtly calls to violence. Things like stand back and stand by, Proud Boys. Things like Madison Cawthorn here in the US saying things like there's going to be bloodshed. Things like that that don't tell people to engage in violence, but seem to advocate it. When they say these things, and they have platforms where they reach millions and millions of people, it just takes one person to interpret that as a call to actual action. And we're seeing that actually play out. People are taking these statements as calls to violent action. So my work now focuses on how people interpret this subtext, trying to engage with how we balance the need to prevent violence with people's First Amendment rights here in the US and freedom to speak freely anywhere else, how to balance that, and how to hold our public officials to account when they say these things that do lead to violence, if not legally, then socially or politically. So I'm interested in how this stochastic terrorism process plays out psychologically in message targets. And I'm interested in laying bare the implications of this violent language, because these politicians are playing a very, very dangerous game with the things that they're saying. And we're seeing kind of the violent fruits of what they've been saying. So that's where I'm headed now, and trying to hold some of these public officials to account, especially when some of what they say leads to violence.
That's really fascinating. Thank you. Thank you very much, Kurt. I mean, what springs to my mind here, I presume there must be a willing section of listeners, if you like, amongst the right radical right-wing milieu who just want somebody to say the word or to say something that they can interpret in a particular way that will make them willing advocates of violence. They just wanted somebody to say the word, even if it's slightly ambiguous, that in a way that can be interpreted for them to take action.
Absolutely. And we're seeing that play out in the trials of the people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. A lot of them, as their defense, they're saying, well, President Trump said these things and I interpreted it as he wanted me to do these things. So many of them, they're just looking for an excuse. And when they have a public official who they value, who they admire, when they say these things, then they see it as a go command, a lot of them. So the argument I'm trying to make, number one, is that words have consequences. Even subtextual words have consequences. Even when you don't mean to direct violence, these individuals should be more careful about the sorts of things they're saying because they're playing with fire. So that's number one. Number two is to show how these sources, how the President Trumps, the Madison Cawthorns, the Marjorie Taylor Greens, far-right politicians in Europe and elsewhere, how what they say affects people's behaviors and how they interpret it psychologically. So it has kind of a twofold, I'm kind of taking a twofold approach here. Number one, what's the psychology behind it? And number two, how do we communicate to these individuals that what they're saying has these negative consequences and make them care about that?
That's really interesting. And I suppose it's a real challenge then to perhaps formally or legally determine some kind of culpability for using a particular type of language that you subsequently draw back from because it may have been slightly ambiguous, yet at the same time has lit the match as far as extreme right wing individuals might be concerned. And that can indirectly or perhaps even more directly lead to violence.
Yeah, that's the balance that I'm really interested in diving into, because I'm not a First Amendment scholar. I am not a media ethicist. But as far as the book that I'm writing now, I'm tracking people down now who are smarter than I am in these regards and interviewing them and getting their input on these kinds of things. My impression is, and I'm fine with this, is that we shouldn't be holding people legally responsible if it doesn't meet the legal standard for incitement. We've seen several incitement trials and it hasn't reached a level of incitement. And I'm a very, very staunch free speech advocate. I am absolutely fine with if it's not incitement, then they shouldn't be held legally accountable. But that doesn't mean there shouldn't be social repercussions or political repercussions for these sorts of things. Sure. So I think that the goal of this work is going to show audiences that the sorts of things that are being said that do lead to violence, even if it doesn't reach the level of incitement, legal incitement, that we need to recognize that this phenomenon does occur and that the individuals who cause it to occur either need to be more cognizant of what they're doing, if they're doing it accidentally, or if they're doing it purposefully, which in some cases I think they are, hold them to some kind of account, if not legally, then politically or socially.
Excellent. That's fascinating. Again, thank you very much. I'm just thinking of all the sort of the political impetus for making these statements as well, as you say. So, Kurt Braddock, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for joining me and sharing your expertise with us.
Anthony, always a pleasure. Good to see you.
Thanks again. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Combating Jihadist Terror. We hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like to see more episodes, they're available to watch on our website, Cogid.org, or to listen to on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Thanks again.